Hi, this is Katrina and Sass, and this is Zooming in the Lens podcast. It's adventures of spiritual dialogue with us from the streets of rock and roll into the shifts of perceptions. We hope Zooming in the Lens can bring us all together, sharing the stuff of life and practice, suffering and grace. And we're really grateful to all of you who might be listening to our rants with compassion and curiosity. For more information, visit us at functionalyogaonline.com. Welcome to Zooming in the Lens, our very first podcast. I'm Katrina Chester, and I have my co-host and my friend, Sass Jordan, with me.
Hey, hi, Sass. Everybody. Hi, Katrina.
So here we are. It's our first podcast, and we came up with this idea because we wanted to create community and be together, talking about topics that range from spirituality to theologies to mysticism.
To practical applications
mostly.
To shoes.
Yes, yes. Practical yeah. Applications, really, really a big deal. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot to know about us, but we're going to try to be brief. But I know it's important whenever I listen to podcasts, I always want to know, who am I talking to? Why am I talking to them? And why are they here? So I thought maybe we would just, I don't know, Sass, if you're cool with it, I'll just ask you, like, who are you? And I know you're a singer. If you don't know Sass, Sass Jordan's an amazing singer. She has been her whole life, among many other things. Mm-hmm. And her and I share that in common. I've been a singer my whole life. I sort of hung up my hat a little bit to go and do endeavors like this for the last 7 years or 6 years or so. And we know each other from that background. But rather than getting to the end of the story, Sass.
Would you please start at the beginning?
I'll start at the beginning. Would you start at the beginning? Tell us, what is it that made you know you wanted to be a singer?
Well, I had a really odd background in the sense that I was the child of British immigrants. We immigrated to Canada when I was about 3 years old, and I was really only exposed to them and their tastes. This is, you know, the early 60s in Montreal, Canada. So
age reveal.
I'm 108, and you know it. So, yeah. And it was very, very small. The world that I was in was extremely small until the age of 8, when there was a massive, massive shift in my life. But before that, the only type of music I was exposed to was what my parents listened to, and they only ever listened to classical music. Mm. So I'd never heard anything with a real, like, drum beat or anything like that until the age of 8, when the family went to India on this wild goose chase of my father's. Mm. My father was a university professor, and he had a sabbatical leave, and he wanted to go to India. But he didn't just want to go by the regular means. He wanted to go on cargo ships, so freighters.
Wow.
So it was about a 3-month journey to get from Canada to India.
Oh, my.
On these oceans and in these wild places. And this is all going through the eyes of an 8-year-old, you know, so it was, you don't have the same programs in place yet, or the same blindnesses or prejudgmental attitudes that you have, you know, once you reach adulthood.
Right.
So it was a completely fascinating experience from that point of view. And also my memory of it is from that viewpoint, the viewpoint of an 8 to 9 year old person, you know. Anyway, so when we got back from India, that's the first time I was exposed to what I would call pop music. My brother and I discovered that you could change the dial on the radio and this different sound came out.
Wow.
And it freaking changed my life. I remember the day it happened, my brother and I were like, what the? oh my God. And the first song we heard that I still etched in my memory to this day was The Night They Drove Old Dixie Down by The Band. It was The Band doing it.
Wow.
You know, and it was just, it was like an epiphany. And my mom came home. She had been grocery shopping. My mom came home. She says, she to this day remembers, she said, you came running at me and you said, Mom, I know what I want to do. I know what I'm going to do with my life. I know what I'm going to do. And it was like, isn't that odd?
Wow.
9 years old. Yeah. And first record I ever got was John Lennon's Imagine. And they were records in those days. Yeah. Kids.
Yeah, absolutely. You know,
it
was,
and so it just seemed the best way, the path of least resistance for me to indulge all the things that I loved. One was getting attention.
Mm.
Two was I loved music. Three, there was an enormous power I could feel in this rock music business. There was not the business, the sound.
Yeah.
The sound and the vibration. Drums are primal. You know, yeah. It's such a big deal. Interestingly enough.
Right.
Because when Katrina tells you her background, drums do play a fairly important part of it.
Right.
In your background.
That's right.
Yeah. And really, it was from that moment on, I would say, until about the age of 35, my whole life was absolutely 100% about music, making it, and just living, breathing it. Everything I did had that as the ultimate goal. It was, you know, people, places, things, irrelevant.
Right.
It was just, is this going to help me or not get to where I want to go? And at that time, yeah. It was like, I want to be a rock star.
Real
whatever
focus.
The hell that is, you know?
Right. Well, and you did.
Yeah, more or less. Yeah. Not what my idea of a rock star was, though.
What was your idea?
My idea of a rock star was Mick Jagger or David Bowie or these world famous, massively huge, you know, Robert Plant.
Right.
Those were my ideas of rock stars. And although I achieved a lot of notoriety and success, I never came close to anything like that.
Right.
Do you see what I mean? So to me, I never became a rock star. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm a rock star? I'm not a goddamn rock star.
Right.
I'll show you a goddamn rock star. And now it's so funny because that is how you and I ended up meeting, is through the fact that we both did the same thing and we ended up meeting.
That's right.
On a little stage off Broadway in New York City where you saved my ass.
Yeah.
However, let's get to that point from your side because I'd like to hear how you got into all this business as well.
Well, my dad was a very well-known session drummer. Yeah.
Drummer.
Yeah. First drummer. Yeah, first drummer for sure. His name is Gary Chester, and he's played on hits like Under the Boardwalk and Twist and Shout and on all Aretha, and just amazing, amazing contributions. And it was back in the day when session players were actually playing sessions. So he was like the East Coast guy, you know, the Brill Building. He did a lot of Motown stuff, and so I grew up with it, and at age 5, I remember seeing The Wizard of Oz on TV. I do, yeah, when we had 4 channels. I think it was 4 channels. Yeah. Okay, so this was 1975, so yeah. 4 channels, and I saw The Wizard of Oz, and I knew instantly when she sung Somewhere Over the Rainbow that that's what I wanted to do. I mean, instantly, it was like Shaktipata. That was like instant transmission of that. This is what I wanted to do. So I ran to my dad, who is Sicilian Bronx. Should paint a nice little picture, musician guy. And I said, you know, I want to be a singer. And he said, well, you got to eat, sleep, and shit music.
Yeah.
And I thought, I could do that. I think I could do that, yeah. Just like my father. For anybody who knows my father, that's a typical Gary Chester thing to say to a 5-year-old, no less. So I grabbed my blankie and I went outside to my hammock and I sung Somewhere Over the Rainbow for what felt like, you know, 7-8 hours, probably was an hour. I'm not really sure. I never will be. And I fell asleep on the hammock. And when I woke up, the blanket was placed on me. And I woke up as a singer. At least I thought I was. So I jumped up and I thought that that was eating, sleeping, and shitting music. So I ran to my dad and I was like, am I a singer now? Am I a singer now? And I think he made a joke like, poof, you're a singer now or something, something funny. And that started my whole relationship to music. And he sort of taught me everything that I know about timing and how to front. Because I, you know, I'm one of those singers that thinks it's more important to be a good front person than it is to actually sing, you know, with a lot of like schooled talent. You know, I'm more of a street person. I never learned how to read music, although my dad was a stickler about it. He made all his students read music because he later on became a teacher and wrote a book called The New Breed, which does really well. And it's an amazing drum community still. My father's passed 25 years now, but he's still really prevalent out there and a big guru for me and a lot of other drummers too. So I grew up like very strict and that I should not open my mouth and sing a note unless I have something to offer people that they can't get anywhere else. Mm. So I sort of, that followed me throughout life. I started out doing commercials at 5, you know, the minute I decided to do that, I got a commercial for Lender's Bagelettes.
Holy.
Yeah. Lender's
crap.
Bagelettes, Lender's Bagelettes. The hole in the middle fits just for you to fit your finger through. It's horrible, right? Oh my God. Yep. I remember that. I remember the producer. I remember everybody involved in it. And that was it. Like, that was my Grammy, pretty much. So, but then, you know, I reached like 8 or 9 after singing amazing classic music and a lot of Aretha and a lot of Etta James and stuff like that. I'm a drummer singer, meaning that like the rest of the band, their sound kind of disappears to me. And what I hear mostly is the timekeeper and the marriages that are coordinated through that relationship is sort of how I sing. So it just so happens that I could sing, honestly. Yeah. I think I don't really remember ever deciding that I had a choice. I think it picked me.
Same me.
Yeah. I think it does, yeah. Right? Like, it just picks you.
Yeah.
Would
you not say that it's probably like that for any profession where the person feels called to it?
Yeah.
You know, I think the profession picks you. We happen to be among the lucky few who had a calling of any
Absolutely.
Kind. You know, it's just, you know, that floundering around that so many people have.
Yeah.
What am I supposed to be doing? It's so
yeah.
painful.
I often have that conversation with people. Is it better to have a passion or to not ever have a passion? And I used to be the person that thought having a passion is way better. But then the more philosophy I discovered and the more I got into alternative ways of thinking, I saw that the chains that bind you could be the very chains that stop you from being able to see without those blinders on. Like, you could probably understand when you were doing music, when you do music, you have blinders on. I
Big
mean,
time.
You're out on the road. You're out on the road. There's like,
survival.
I don't even know what day it is.
That's right.
So there's those blinders. And when you don't know what you're going to do, it's sort of like how you would say the greatest person to spiritually seek is somebody that already knows they don't know anything.
Mm-hmm.
So I kind of attribute it to if you have somebody that has no passion, it's a wide open landscape. And the only thing making them suffer is that everybody else seems to know what they want to do. So
right.
It makes you suffer because you think something's wrong with you.
Because you're
don't.
Comparing.
Because you're comparing, yeah. And then you have this whole part, you know, start of the programming. But anyway, then I discovered rock and roll. That's where my heart was, AC/DC.
Why was your heart in rock and roll?
I think that it hit me at a time when hormones were going crazy. And
power.
Yeah. And I think it was definitely the angst part of it. I also, I felt more at home up there than I ever felt down here. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a lame excuse now, because I think a full person involved in life doesn't say things like that. But, you know, of course, we're all not there yet. But I at some point in my rock and roll life thought, oh, I'm going to really try to sing pretty, or I'm going to try to, like, and I remember, you know, a lot of other artists coming to those conclusions, like, you know, those comments you get of, can't you just sing a song without screaming? You know those comments?
Yeah. Had one or two of those in my life.
But, you know, it's just our expression. I can't say that I never put it on. It just was a part of me. It's just who I am. And I really felt it to my core. And it was an era thing, you know? I mean, it was the 80s and 90s, and I met the right musicians at the right time. I got my first deal. I had a great band. I could never take it away. I toured 300 days a year for a long time. You know, just living on a bus or a van, and, you know, showering in the Burger King in Tulsa, you know.
I know.
Wherever. Anywhere you go.
I'm still doing that.
Yeah.
Oh, dear God.
Yeah, man. I mean, you just live it. You do, uh-huh. you do what you do. I never had a B plan, ever. I'm so glad I didn't.
No.
You just go.
Did you have any other interests at the time, though? Were there other things that occupied your mind besides the music?
Yeah.
Like?
Well, it's going to sound crazy, but I really loved archaeology a lot. Like, I loved the whole idea of finding other worlds and alternative ideas and existences and things like that. I dug. And really early on, when I was really little, like, it probably started about 6 or 7, I had this neighbor named Mr. O'Neill. Coolest story. He was a really old man then. He was probably like 40. He's really old. No, seriously, I do think he was like 60. He was an anthropologist.
An anthropologist, not an archaeologist. Okay.
And an archaeologist.
Okay.
Okay, yeah. Mr. O'Neill. Never knew his first name. My mom might, but I don't. And he lived next door, and he smoked a pipe, and I found his garden interesting. So I would go and knock on his door, and this became a ritual for 6, 7 years. When everybody else was playing hide-and-go-seek, I would knock on Mr. O'Neill's door. He would let me in. It was like, meow! The door squeaked open. You'd go in. It was like Raiders of the Lost Ark in there. There was a giant fireplace, books everywhere, the ladder that swings side by side, bones and maps and globes. And a fire was always on, and he'd be smoking this amazing pipe, and we would sit down, and he'd say, "What's in store for us today, Katrina?" And he would tell me stories of, like, great lands, and he taught me basics of what I now know to be, like, Buddhism and Hinduism and the Tao. And
what the hell?
And it was amazing. So he really started me off on that. And, of course, my dad was very spiritually inclined, too. He taught a lot of his students more the philosophy of drums than he did about anything else. If you ask them, they'll tell you stories of, it was like a therapy session in with my father. He was making the drums a part of your body. They're extensions of your body. They're not separate. They're all one. So I think that I was primed to be involved in alternative ways of thinking.
100%.
Yeah. So I was really inspired by that. So yes, you asked me the question. Yes, I had a lot of other ideas. I don't know if I could have put them into words then.
Back burner.
Yeah. But I started reading really early.
Me too.
I was very bad in school.
Me too.
really not good with the whole authority thing and being embarrassed that I didn't know the answer, which is a part of the reason why I wanted us to do this podcast, because I feel like there's a lot of people out there, whether it's they're going through school or they're mothering or they're dating or, you know, jobs or just like, you know, trying to find a community of people that speak of things in this nature without feeling ridiculed that you're not sitting there, you know, knowing everything that the world thinks you should be knowing about these kinds of philosophies or discoveries in life.
Or that you're not just completely obsessed with the mall and, you know, getting married.
Right.
You know, because that has a finite appeal. And I think that more and more people are getting less and less interested. Well, I'd like to think that.
Right.
I think that anyone who's listening to this is definitely not satisfied with malls and marriage.
Right, right, right. Or, you know, the struggles of just how to go through daily life and bring practical applications of, you know, I even hate the word spirituality at this point. It's so overused. Yeah. But like, how do we actually get on a journey to really knowing who we are and being okay with that and using the life that we have and the people in our life as our practice. And that really, you know, I don't know, that kind of started for me at a really young age. And until I found yoga in particular, I didn't really have a name for it. And now I even feel like the things that I study have far surpassed even just that title, per se. I'm not really one for titles. I'd rather say I'm, you know, a human conditioner, you know, whatever.
I'm a human being.
Yeah. Yeah. And we're all just trying to, you know, feel a part of each other and of something. And it's really hard to do that because I think a lot of things try to get put into a box at a very early age. And, you know, that kind of happened to me with music. You know, I was told that I needed to be tattooed and pierced if I was going to scream my ass off and sing about boy kind of things. And
really?
Yeah,
Who told you that?
A guy at a record company that will remain unnameless.
Wow, I managed. That didn't happen to me.
Yeah, yeah. They told me, here's the exact quote. At 10 o'clock, you're Sheryl Crow. At 2 o'clock, you're Courtney Love. You need to make up your mind. And I stood up in the meeting and I said, I'm 12 o'clock. Why can't I be 12 o'clock? Why do I have to be like somebody else?
Sheryl or Courtney.
Yeah. I mean,
I'm,
you know,
Katrina.
That's erroring it, you know, but, yeah. But yeah, I mean, I just wanted to do it. I wrote these songs with these great players, man. And I was really inspired by my band. And, you know, for whatever reason, it was the single greatest experience ever. But I think we're still trying to do that. You know, life is trying to put us in those boxes. And although I understand that from like a neuroscience point of view, why things need to be relatable, I think sometimes they can make us feel separate and alone. So
extremely.
Yeah.
That's another reason that I was interested in doing this podcast.
Yeah.
And I think you were too, is have an arena in which people can go, wow, I guess I'm not the only one who thinks these things. Mm. I guess I'm not the only one. That was another reason why I started singing. I'm sorry, I forgot to say that. It was a way for me to help other people the way I felt I'd been helped, which was that when I started listening to this music and these singers and these people, I was like, oh my God, I'm not alone. I'm not the only one who thinks these things. I'm not the only one who feels this way. To whatever degree and for whatever they were singing about, it didn't matter. It was even just the actual energy that was coming through. It was like, I can relate to this. I can resonate to this. I'm not alone.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And really, that's got a lot to do with the stuff that we're going to be talking about, I think, over the course of these discussions.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that we're, you know, feeling alone is, I think, one of the most horrific feelings we can have as human beings, that I'm alone.
Yeah.
No one understands. No one cares. No one can see me. No one can hear me.
Right.
You know? And right. And I've got it all hidden under a mask of something that's culturally acceptable, that's mm-hmm. socially acceptable. You know? I mean, is that really your goal, that you just get married and have children? Not that that's a bad thing. It's a wonderful thing.
No, it's fantastic.
But that's,
yeah.
that's it?
Right.
There's right. nothing else? You know? Wow. Can't deal with that.
Right, right.
Well.
Yeah. I mean, maybe that's an underlining subconscious reason of why you and I took this path of sort of forging forward with music.
Absolutely. You know? But the irony and the thing that we wanted to share with the listeners is that we both started out in a similar place
yes.
as singers in rock bands and had a lot of similar types of experiences. I mean, you were crap at school. I was crap. I'm a dropout. I never made it to the end. But I had an enormous amount. I'm enormously self-taught. I read like crazy history, right. geography.
Oh, you're really brilliant person. You are.
Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
And, you know, just I absorbed tons of information. Not saying it's true information, but I've absorbed tons of information, different ways of thinking and looking at things, especially mm-hmm. because I was exposed to Eastern thinking and philosophy, albeit at a very young age, therefore not particularly advanced, but it was still the basic tenets
right.
came across to me. And also, you know, with Western religion and culture and civilization, because I lived in it, all these things, both of us have had parallel experiences, and of all the odd ironies, don't we both end up being fascinated with alternate ways of thinking outside of these boxes that we have been put in culturally, socially yeah. and culturally, thinking of healing
yeah.
and being healed, of how can I really help others and myself? Mm-hmm. How do I get through this extraordinarily terrifying reality that I seem to find myself in these days, which, you know, Orwellian, big brothery society that we're in, mm-hmm. you know, oh my God, it's utterly fascinating and exciting, and this is just going to be the coolest journey.
I know. And really, for you and I, it started in, I did this show called Love Janice off Broadway in New York, and I think it was 2002.
It was 2002.
And I was doing the show, and it was kicking my ass, and I was doing it, and blah, blah, blah. And then you should probably tell it from your angle, because your angle's great.
I was in...
Then all of a sudden, yeah, they say...
I was in Toronto. I was actually living in where I live now, you know, outside of Toronto.
Right, right.
In Canada. Internet was still fairly early on.
Right,
because it's
right.
2002. So don't forget, 9/11 has just happened.
I could never.
So yeah. I know you could never.
No.
I could never. None of us who lived through it
none of us
forget
could
that.
Ever.
And the music business had basically shut down.
Mm-hmm.
There was really nothing going on. There wasn't anything going on in any business, really, at that time. Everybody was so terrified,
right.
you know. And so I had a young baby, a young child, my husband and I and her. And, you know, we needed to have some kind of an income because this was not good.
Right.
So I got into my space. And I went into what I call co-creative with the one or God.
Right.
I went into that space. And I just started doing the meditations and the imaginations and everything. And I imagined getting an email, which indeed happened, saying, you know, we're offering you a job. I didn't flesh out the details. At any rate, the job was, would you please come to New York, we will pay for you to get here, and we want you to audition for this show called Love Janice, which is all about Janis Joplin. Myself not being much of a huge fan of Janis Joplin at that
right.
time.
I remember that, right.
You know, I was like, oh God, well, whatever. This is a free trip to go see my best friend, Loretta.
Right.
Yay. And I was about 3 months away from going on a tour with an outfit called the Voices of Classic Rock, and we had a tour of Southeast Asia coming up. So they flew me down. I got the job through no fault of my own. I don't know how I did that because I really didn't want it, but I couldn't say no. Right. And the reason I didn't want it was because it was the most disgusting amount of work.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, it was dear hard. God. It was the hardest job ever.
Yeah.
Anyways, I'll skip all that. And I end up and I'm in New York, and now I've got, there's five shows before I have to get up on that stage.
Yep.
And do the show. I can watch five shows, and then I have to get up there and do it. Well, there's 19 songs to learn of an artist that I was never into.
Right.
And there are what they call sides, which is when you have to speak a part. I thought it was only singing. I was the singing Janice. I was incorrect, ladies and gentlemen. The singing Janice talked. What the fuck? Anyways, that did not make me happy. However, right. I had to learn it. And then there was also the blocking, remembering where you had to be on the stage when you said this line.
Yeah.
I know, you know, my goodness gracious me.
Boy.
And I was alone, completely alone. I had no friends or family because my friend Loretta, who I was staying with, her father passed and she had to leave and I was there alone. It was not fun. Mm. It was very scary. And I'm in the big, you know, the big smoke, the Big Apple, and, you know, that's not a small town.
No.
At any rate. And I've been living in the country. So I go from the country to the Big Apple.
Right.
Off Broadway. And I got to do all this stuff. Well, the person who saved me was Katrina Chester.
Oh.
You saved my ass. And I've told you this a million times over and over again, because you were kind enough and generous enough and loving enough to take me under your wing and show me the ropes of it. I would not have been able to do this without you. I would never have made it. Never. Never. And there were parts that were really, really tough to sing that I couldn't get the timing and the phrasing on because it was just overwhelming, too much information at once. There was the emotional aloneness.
Yeah, right.
All of those things you made better. I mean, you made it so that I could stand it. You know, so I will never forget Kat for that, just for that. And this was at a point in our lives where we were both nascent as far as our spirituality. I mean, it had not come out to the degree, you know, where we're at now, obviously. This is, I don't know how many years later. Let's not just be 20 years. It's a long time.
Yeah, 12 years.
12 years, thank you, not 20. Thank you.
Yeah, I can't not do 20.
Yeah, so 12 years later. So a lot happens in that time. And it was such a wild and intense experience for me. You know, it was for you, I'm sure. Not knowing me, but just that, the incredible workload.
Yeah,
of it. Well, and having to take care of your voice in a way, you know, it was a 2.5 hour show or 2 hours and 15 minutes.
Yeah, it was brutal.
And it was relentless and nonstop. And there were 8 costume changes that we had to navigate on our own with these stupid wigs on. And God, it was insane. It was insane.
It was quite an experience being like, as you were, you know, rock and roll singer, front person, to just all of a sudden have to play somebody else. And I only really wanted the role because they were really against us being impersonators. Like, they really wanted us to be us. So I was allowed to get up there, even though I was in costume, I was allowed to get up there and sort of still have some semblance of myself. Because, you know, I never claimed to be an actress or anything. But, you know, it did get me into acting a lot. Like, I ended up taking acting lessons, and I was enjoying, because really acting is absolutely self-study. I mean, inside out, outside in, whatever you're looking at it anyway. I mean, it's all comparable. So, you know, for me, even when I was touring with my band, I was reading, you know, I'd be the person on the bus reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead. So, or deciphering through the Bible or whatever it was, I kind of always was that person. I just never really found anything that wasn't binding me. Like, if I wanted to go study something, I found it very constricting to have all these rules. I grew up, you know, Roman Catholic. Mm-hmm. Not strict or anything, but, you know, I made my communion, my confirmation. Mm-hmm. And I found it too confining, because the minute I asked questions, I was thrown out of religion. And I found that to be the most interesting thing when I finally went to do a teacher training and, you know, get some real studies in the topics we're talking about now. I found out that, you know, they encourage questions. But I had a hard time finding people that I could actually answer the questions. So even though they had them, I didn't get a lot answered. So it started me on a forever journey that I imagine, you know, I'm very grateful for, but I had to go out and find out for myself. And so part of the reason why I wanted to do this podcast was because I think that there's probably more people out there like us, whether you've done a yoga teacher training or you've studied Tai Chi or you're a healer or you're just somebody looking to involve movement with, you know, practical applications of spirituality, or you're somebody that's interested in crystals or whatever. Mm-hmm. Something that is of this nature, it could feel like you don't know where to turn or where to go. And most of the podcasts that I was listening to at the time, or the audio or the books, quite frankly, like, I could understand maybe half of it, but then I couldn't understand the other half. And, you know, who knows what the other half was saying? It was probably really important, but I didn't catch it.
But these were all experts as well, right?
Absolutely. They
and
were all
we're
experts.
Not.
No, we're
just
not.
We're experts at surviving.
We're students. We're consummate students, yeah, of the human condition, and fully aware that there is a soul and we are having a human experience. And I really like that, because it puts in perspective that what's really going on here is that we're not identifying enough without whatever tools. You could go to, I love religion. I love belief systems. I love all of it. We're in a day and age where you could cherry pick some of them, get stuck in the modality, only to have to get out of the modality again to try to learn stuff, to only have to undo the learning. Yeah. Because you want to come in as an empty vessel. And as my teacher Ram Dass always says, be careful what you put in your head, Katrina, because you're only going to have to take it out.
Yeah.
I think that there's more people out there like us that just don't know where the community of people that are speaking real talk from a street perspective with a practical angle of, like, what does it mean to be standing as the witness? What does it mean when they speak, you know, loving the self from within, or...
Yeah, what the hell does that mean?
Right.
Exactly.
There's a lot of that goes on, mm-hmm, and I think there's a lot of people that maybe are too shy to admit that.
Mm-hmm.
I find that, you know, as I studied, I mean, I've logged thousands and thousands of hours on retreats and workshops and trainings and, mm-hmm, you name it. I then all of a sudden started teaching. And as I started teaching, I started really understanding how profound these ideas really are, even now. Like, they were brought to us by people like Ram Dass and Alan Watts.
Krishnamurti.
Absolutely. And so many influential people.
Oh God, yeah.
And, like, talk about 50s, 60s, 70s, whatever. But here we are in 2000 and what? 14.
14.
Right? 2014. And I still find that I could say one word of a piece of a lecture of Ram Dass or any of the people we spoke of. Mm-hmm. And it's like some people have never heard it before. And you see the look in their eyes.
Uh-huh.
That is just as powerful as me getting up there and singing.
I was going to say, it's an extension of what we were doing before. It's the same thing. It's the reaching out and the connecting at a visceral level with another,
right,
and expanding into the moment through that. Music is absolutely that,
yeah,
you know, And so are these ideas. When you are looking and looking and you're desperate, and all of a sudden Hafiz comes along.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And he says, the sun never looks at the earth and says, you owe me.
You owe me, right?
Oh, right. My God.
Yeah.
I mean, just that there, I could weep because it's just so profound.
Yeah. And for those of you that don't know, he's a poet. And
a Persian Sufi poet from like the Rumi.
Yeah.
I think he was before Rumi, but, and there's some fantastic, Daniel Ludinsky, is that the name of the guy? Some fantastic translations of his work. There's one in particular, that book is called The Gift. It's all a translation of Hafiz's poems, and just, you know, it's extraordinary stuff. And so intriguing, too, because here we are in 2014, like you're saying, and this stuff is like 900, I mean, I don't even know when it's from. It's so long ago.
And
from a culture that is so removed.
So profound, right? And I can see yoga teachers now, like, they're spitting it out like it's the ABCs of yoga. Middle of asana classes, the physical postures, they'll just be quoting Rumi and Kabir.
It's extraordinary stuff. So this, none of this information that you and I are so fascinated with and are really deep students of is anything new.
No, no.
There's nothing new.
No, no. There's only the newness of our
discovery.
Of our discoveries and wanting to, you know, share that and it because it really has absolutely changed my life.
And we want to explore it and share it through the lens of this time frame.
Exactly.
And what we are dealing with in our daily lives as, you know, women.
Yeah, as time, people.
As people in this time.
Yeah, that's what time. Zooming in the lens is. You know, it's zooming in the lens. You have to, I think it was Gurdjieff who, I'll badly quote it, but you have to know you're in prison before you could break out.
Before you could break out. Yeah, exactly. And so what we want to do in this series of discussions is explore some of these ideas and how we take these ideas and apply them. Yeah. We want to look at the spaces in between these ideas, wherein lies most of the power of the ideas. I mean, that's an odd thing to say, to explain what I mean there. Take me a minute.
Yeah, and it's hard because a lot of it is the unexplainable. Exactly. Some of it is because of our ignorance, and some of it is because it's just unexplainable.
Yeah, and we're learning.
It's in the feeling. I will say that. It's not in the thinking. It's in the feeling, and that's a really hard thing to describe. But I think blending the two, which I've been doing for a while now, of I have an idea, and then where do I feel it in my body? Things like that sound crazy, you know, and to the world not currently practicing or maybe people who aren't able to, it sounds like a crazy idea. But neuroscience is even coming up with ways to explain what happens to your brain when you start creating new neural pathways because of our plasticity, because of our ability to change the brain. We once thought you couldn't even do that. Remember when everybody said, roll up your windows, mom and dad, kids in the back seat, smoke a cigarette.
Oh, my God.
It'll be fine. Well, it's kind of like that with the brain, you know? We always said old dogs can't learn new tricks, but you know what? They can.
Yes.
They can.
And so, so can DNA,
that's
apparently.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you can reprogram DNA.
Right.
When you look at Bruce Lipton's work and you know, that kind of, that whole path of biology and the biology of belief and all that kind of thing, you know, you start to realize that our walls are transparent.
Right.
You know, and to get to the point where you don't have to doggedly defend a program or a belief that you have, and you can realize that there are many, many, there's billions of worlds. There's a world for each being on the planet.
That could be.
Because that being has its own world. It sees things through its own lens through its right. own way, you know, and so they live in their own world. How many times a day do you say that? Well, he's in his own world.
Right.
Of course he's in his own world. I'm in mine and you're in yours. And we're right. all, where are our points of complicity? Where do we meet through these walls, through these hopefully transparent walls? We want to get them transparent.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's inspiring stuff, and I don't think there's enough, you know, without putting ourselves down, sophomoric sort of conversation about it. I think it's...
Layperson.
Yeah.
I think that's... We think of ourselves that way.
I always will. I don't care if I, you know, have been attending university for 15 years. I always want to keep the beginner's mind because no matter what I put in there, I got to take it back out.
So, thanks, Ram Dass.
Right. Thank you, Ram Dass. Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I'm inspired by the topics because, honestly, the struggle that I had in trying to have anybody who could help me. Mm-hmm. I didn't really get a lot of offers. You know, it's a little misguiding when you get into this spiritual, for lack of a better word, world of mm-hmm. seekers. You think it's going to be all like butterfly tails and you know, happy like
unicorns.
Unicorns, exactly. But, you know, honestly, it's few and far between. Like, I actually found a lot of people very holding information closely and tightly. Then I, you know, it never occurred to me that it was because maybe they didn't know the answers until the person I'm with now said, I don't think they know the answers. I had so much compassion. Great that they, I don't, if that's fine with me, if you don't know the answers. But somebody,
be honest.
Don't make me feel like I'm crazy for, you know, wanting to ask these things. So I feel like there's probably people out there that may feel the same way as we do. You don't have to be a girl. You could be a boy. You could be a man. You could be a kid.
A Martian.
You could be a Martian. We just want to, you know, bring awareness around the dialogue of how do we use these things? How are he and I, how are Sass and I, excuse me, how are we applying it? What struggles do we have? And there's so much to learn from each other.
God.
I mean, even just the listeners too, like we want you to email us and ask us any topics you want to talk about, anything you're confused about, anything that you're positive about, you know, whatever. We're kind of open books, and I'm trying to be the voice that maybe I never really had. And don't get me wrong, I had a lot of people that did help me along the way, obviously, mm-hmm. or I wouldn't be here right now. But the majority of the people that one would turn to when trying to get studies like this, I just always felt like it was somebody trying to get me to buy their book.
Uh-huh.
You know?
Or their religion. Yeah. Or their whatever.
Yeah, yeah, I did.
That's, yeah.
There's, yeah, and I don't blame them. You know, listen, everybody's got to make a living. I get it. But, you know, I really am a person that would eat, sleep, and shit what I'm doing.
Just hopefully not all in the same place.
Right, right. Which is what musicians tend to do.
Yes, because we have no choice. The most unglamorous of lives. No?
Right, right.
I know. I think that was taken care of with those behind the music documentaries and stuff like that. People started to get a little bit of a taste of the true reality.
Oh, boy, yeah.
Of our glamorous lives.
Yeah, well, what have you found, Sass, just so before we end it today, in honor of zooming in, the lens. Mm-hmm. Zoom us into your lens a little bit, into maybe one thing that you're currently looking for tools or have found a tool to sort of, you know, get underneath.
Well, I tend to be a personality that really goes on feeling. I'm much more right-brained than... the right brain in me and the left brain in me are pretty often in a bit of an altercation. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not kidding. And so what happens is there's a standoff, and it's paralyzing. It's a paralysis factor.
Wow.
So I have to default to either one or the other. My goal at this time would be to find a way to meld the two so that we get into a whole brain type of situation. And that's something I'm really intrigued to pursue with you,
mm-hmm.
because of your studies in neuroscience and the plasticity of the brain, like you were talking about earlier. Like, I'm really, that's something I really want to get into, and I'm sure I'm not the only one. So I work at this time mostly with visualization and what you would call mantra. And it's extraordinarily powerful, and it really, really does make a difference and help me a lot through the daily trials and tribulations of an ordinary life, you know. And,
for those who don't know what mantra is,
Would be you explain it, because I
so mantra's like a
sentence or word.
Yeah, it's I can't remember the exact definition of it, but I think it's like mind changing or not mind numbing, but
it's like, it's almost hypnotic in a sense.
It is definitely hypnotic, but I'm forgetting the definition for some reason. Forgive me.
Yeah, well,
I know this. It's just at the back of my brain. But you can repeat a mantra. Om Mani Padme Hum. Om Mani Padme Hum. These are just things that I personally feel when you get into a routine and you chant over and over again, there's an element of a surrender.
And you stop the mind. You stop
that's
thinking
the surrender.
Process.
Yeah, that's the surrender.
It's the thinking process think. That you want to stop.
Yeah.
Because like Tommy said the other day, a friend of ours said the other day, and it didn't come from him, obviously, but he was just reminding me. He was saying, you know, we spend way too much time thinking and not enough time feeling.
Right.
And I was just complaining about that, but I spend an enormous amount of time in the feeling, realm of feeling as well.
Right.
You know what I mean? I want them to meet. You need the two of them. This is the realm of duality. You need these two things. You need the thinking and the feeling.
Mm-hmm.
One without the other is unbalanced.
Right.
It's just, there's no balance there. So that is really, that's what I'm into. And you can, I know that there's ways to approach the blending the two halves of the brain through physical exercises as well as mental exercises. And that's really intriguing to me as well. And we can maybe get into some of those.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, mantra's great for that. It's a discipline for sure. I think, you know, the first thing that I always try to tell people is to maybe change the language behind, I need to stop my brain. I need to stop my brain, because that's still in the doing. You know, you're still having to do. I say, let the brain be the brain. It has nothing to do with you. You know, and for lack of sounding too woo-woo, you know, using the heart area as a metaphor or an actual organ or a place, I think that if we can make that mean more feeling, less thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it happens, you know. I think it's the minute you say, I'm going to do this, as Alan Watts always says, you don't want to alert the devil, you know?
Yeah.
And I find that, like, I alert the devil every day. And, mm-hmm. and every day I'm reminded, shit, I just alerted the devil. And then,
that old bastard.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm just totally alerting the devil. So I think the process of stopping your mind is not really a stopping at all. It moves into a place of like allowing.
There you go. Thank you. That's the word.
Yeah, allowing is a good word.
Into my most favorite topic of the moment, which is non-resistance.
Right.
Resistance right. is futile. I think we're going to have an entire discussion on that.
Yeah, we're going to have a separate podcast for that because that is a really good one.
Oh, my goodness. And, you know, it does come from Star Trek.
Does it?
Yes, when the Borg want to assimilate everybody.
Are you a Trekkie?
Kind of in a way, because there's so many brilliant things that came from that show.
Yeah, I never got into it.
Well,
if
I'll just show you a couple later. After.
Really?
Yeah, I'll show you a couple of things that are just, it's stunning.
Right.
It's like, how did they know? How did they know this was on its way?
Right.
Us, it's completely.
Yeah, that is pretty far out. I think that way about the Jetsons.
Well, it's all the same stuff.
But I'm waiting for the flying cars.
Science fiction is just prediction.
Right, right.
Science prediction.
Well, I think what Sass and I are going to do is maybe do something like this, maybe once every 2 weeks, maybe even once a month. We're not really sure, but we're really thankful that you joined us. And I wanted to read this to send you off with something to actually maybe check out that's been really helping me. It's a quote by Pema Chodron, mm-hmm. Living without an agenda. It's big words.
Oh, yeah.
Could our minds and our hearts be big enough to just hang out in that space where we're not entirely certain about who's right and who's wrong? Could we have no agenda when we walk into a room with another person, not know what to say, not make the person right or wrong? Could we see, hear, feel other people as they really are? It is powerful to practice this way because we'll find ourselves continually rushing around to try to feel secure again, to make ourselves or them either right or wrong. But true communication can only happen in that open space. I love that.
Beautiful.
Imagine walking into a room and having no agenda. That's what we are doing here.
I think so.
I do.
Think that's part of our friendship.
Yeah.
To a large degree. It's something I think that we keep in mind. And the fact that there's kindred spirit, you know, is just so exciting.
Yeah.
And so much fun. And really, the bottom line of this lifetime for me is fun.
Oh, without a doubt. It's play.
That's like my entire MO.
Yeah.
I gotta have fun.
Absolutely.
Even the drama and the shit at one point, at some point, it's fun.
Yeah. Yeah, you know? And a bit of a warning to anybody out there, we do have trash mouths at times.
Yeah, we're rock chicks, for God's sake.
But we mean it with love and grace from the heart.
Yep.
And I want to personally thank my teacher who's been, you know, changed my life personally, to Ram Dass, who, you know, is not able to travel and teach anymore, but he's in Maui and has amazing retreats. And I do have pretty extensive lists that I want to offer up to anybody of great retreats, great yoga, great books, great podcasts.
Great resources.
Absolutely. There's so many great resources. You can email me at katfromicca@gmail.com. And you can ask me for any of those resources. I can even recommend meditations that you can get online. Whatever it is that you feel is going to help you. I do not know everything. Let's just make it very clear here. I am not trying to be a guru. I have no interest in being a guru.
Because I don't know anything.
I know very little. But what I do know, I am more than willing and happy to share. And I hope you could grow with us because I'm averaging a good couple of thousand hours of studying a week alone. I got this great neuroscience conference coming up on Friday, which I'm really
so
excited about. Yeah, I definitely want to have a podcast about that. So we're going to end this with just teaching you, I guess, what is a good mantra/meditation that you can walk away with as well. why you practice trying to walk into a room with no agenda. Exactly. So as we lower the head to the heart, just to show that the mind is going to bow to the heart, no matter what we talk about, no matter how we say it, no matter whatever judgments there are from ourselves or from those out there, there has to be a love and a compassion that comes from the heart with all of this kind of stuff and what we share, that it does truly come from just love. I have a body, but I am not this body. This body have movements, but I am not these movements. I have a mind, but I am not this mind. This mind has thoughts, but I am not these thoughts. These thoughts give me feelings, but I am not these feelings. Who am I? I am loving awareness. And as we say, namaste, I bow to the one in you. And I thank you very much for being a part of us and welcoming SAS and welcoming you. And we'll see what comes out of this. We've got a lot of episode ideas, some rock and roll sort of fun topics mixed in with spirituality. And
Yeah, baby.
And send any questions you want. And thank you very much for joining Zooming in the Lens.
Thank you.
Bye.
4, to put it more even straighter, we are each entering into a contract to get straight or become conscious ourselves through the use of group process. That's the only really way we can say it. That if you think you can become more conscious by another means other than being with other people, do it.
Special thank you to Ian Hatton for the music and editing for Zooming in the Lens. For more information on Ian, go to mixforpix, mixforpix.com.